This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Emma Rice, a winemaker at Hattingley, but also you set up and run Custom Crush, which is a wine lab based in Hampshire in England. How are you, Emma?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Once you've finished your fermentation, you can do normal tests like tests for alcohol levels. I think most people sort of know what's going on there. But you guys can also do a test for volatile acidity. Do you want to just explain to people what volatile acidity is and why you'd test for it?
It's essentially what we do. The test is a measure of acetic acid levels. And so, as most people in the wine industry will know, any wine will eventually turn to vinegar. It might take 100 years or it could take, 2 days. Well, it depends on the conditions. But essentially, acetic acid is a byproduct of dirty winemaking. So you want to monitor it. And it's not, things happen. It could be from slightly dirty grapes and they come in and add a bit of rot. It could be from slightly dirty sample valve that didn't get cleaned properly on the tank, or a barrel that's gone a bit volatile. Which, it does happen. You can do everything you can to prevent it happening, but inevitably sometimes it does. So you want to make sure you're not putting a contaminated wine that's got very high levels of acetic acid into another one. Or you don't want to put a good wine into a tank that's just had a wine in it with high volatile acidity without steam cleaning that or sterilizing that tank first. It's maintaining the health of the winery and the health of the wines, just to monitoring them. And so if you see, you check immediately after fermentation for your volatile acidity and then you check again pre-bottling. If it's gone up hugely, you know that you've probably got a problem in there. Even if it's not quite yet at the levels of sensory threshold, you can see if it's creeping up. So if you check on a regular basis what your volatile acidity is, you can hopefully detect if there's a problem heading your way in the future.
And again, that's another bacteria.
Acetobacter, that
causes it. So it's more about making sure things don't go wrong. But some wines are quite high in VA. If you think about Barolos, they historically have had high VAs. And a lot of people would say a little bit of VA can actually help lift the wine, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But I imagine for sparkling wine production, it's probably not the sort of aroma that you're looking for.
No. Well, the key thing about sparkling wines, the base wines going in, need to be relatively neutral, because by the time you've added the bubble through the second fermentation, the bubble exaggerates everything. So while you very rarely see a new oak being used in sparkling winemaking, or and why the yeast that most people use are fairly neutral yeast. They don't produce really fruity aromas. It's why when you're doing malolactic fermentation, you don't want those buttery diacetyl characters, because by the time you've put the bubble into the glass, then all of those things are exaggerated hugely. So you need to start with a fairly neutral base wine, and volatile acidity would be one of those things that could become unbearably overpowering by the time you've got the bubble in there. Okay. Might be nice as a base wine, but by the time you've got the bubble in there, it's too much.
Okay, one of the things you test after fermentation, but you don't do before fermentation, is free sulfur dioxide and the total sulfur dioxide in a wine. Alcoholic fermentation naturally produces a little bit of sulfur dioxide anyway, but people sometimes after fermentation will add SO2 to it. What's the difference between free and total? And if you're going to go through a secondary alcoholic fermentation to make a sparkling wine, why would you add sulfur dioxide before that?
So we add a little bit of sulfur dioxide to the juice at pressing. So here at Hattingley, we have a very oxidative process, juice handling process. So the presses are all open vat presses and you can't inert gas them. And we don't want to. So we oxidize the juice to a certain extent in the early stages. And then we add a small amount, about 30 parts per million, to the juice to settle it in tank. 48 hours later, we rack it. And we might check at that point to see what the total level of SO2 is. Because all the free SO2 is going to get bound up It's not going to be, there's not going to be much free SO2 hanging around, but just to check what the total SO2.
Just for the listeners, free SO2 tends to bind up with oxygen and just help stop oxidation of the wine. And what you're saying is the juice is coming in with a little bit of oxygen in there, so you add a tiny amount and it does all get bound up, help prevent oxidation of the wine.
It's at that point, it's just to stop the juice oxidizing too far. And you want a little bit of SO2 in there just to stop a fermentation happening too quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to settle the juices for about 48 hours before we then rack and inoculate. So it's to stop that fermentation happening spontaneously in that first 48 hours. And then we actively encourage the fermentation, and that chomps up any free SO2 that's left, and obviously produces a little bit by itself as well. And then obviously we finish fermentation, whether it's malolactic fermentation or alcoholic fermentation or both, in November, December. We're not bottling some of those wines until June, so we can't just let them sit there without protecting them. So we do add a post-fermentation addition of between 30 and 40 parts per million. And hopefully that will be the only addition we ever have to make until we get to bottling stage, blending and bottling. We might have some will need a little bit more than others, depending on what's going on in the wine. But you just need to monitor what your free and total SO2 is, because the free SO2, if it's too high, will actually stop the yeast from working in the bottle. So mm-hmm. you've got it's a very fine line between protecting the wine and actually stopping a fermentation from happening in the bottle later on. The total SO2, again, is important because it will have an effect on the ability of the yeast to go through the second fermentation. Not as vital, but you do need to watch it. And there are legal maximums as well that you have to adhere to. Even if you're not adding anything, you need to know what your SO2 levels are, both free and total.
Yeah, and also you need to look at it in respect to the pH as well, because the lower the pH, the less SO2 you need. Is that right?
Yes. So it's not just free and total SO2, it's also molecular SO2. And so you need somewhere between 0.5 and 0.8 parts per million molecular SO2 in order to inhibit microbial activity. So if your pH is at 3, which is fairly normal for an English-based wine, then if your free SO2 is at 11 parts per million, your molecular is going to be at 0.8, and therefore second fermentation will not happen, or it will have great difficulty. And 11 parts per million is very low level of free SO2. So, you know, we get very worried when our SO2 free SO2 levels go into double figures, because our pHs are generally 3 or below. And, you know, it can happen and has happened that you've got a pH of 2.9, a free SO2 of 8, and it's just been enough to inhibit that second fermentation, and so the fermentation will go very slowly. It might get stuck, and that's what you don't want to happen. So you've got to constantly consider what your pH is in relation to your total SO2, as well as other things, as you know, going into bottle. There are so many limiting factors, and we've got most of them here in England.
What's molecular SO2? I've never heard of that term before.
It's the bit of the SO2 that is actually active, unable to stop microbial activity. So that's the bit that it's at a molecular level, the level you need to have in order to make sure that your wine is microbially stable, or for us is in a state at which you can actively get the yeast to work.
How does that differ from free SO2? Is free SO2 about oxidation and mopping up the oxygen in the tank, and molecular is about stopping the microbial? Is that the difference?
Well, the free SO2 is a fixed number. This is how much free SO2 there is in your wine or your juice. Mm-hmm. The molecular is a calculation between the free and the pH that gives you a true reading of how effective that free SO2 will be at that pH. That's the difference.
Okay, so yeah, no, okay, I've got it. I've got you. Excellent, excellent. Okay, and then the only other test, because I'm just going through all the different tests that you guys do. You do a cold stabilization and a heat stabilization. I'm not actually quite sure what that is.
So under English wine law, as it stands, a still wine has to be heat stable in order for it to pass the PDO test, the protected designation of origin test. But it doesn't have to be cold stable. aesthetically you might want it to be, but it doesn't have to be. And the opposite is true for sparkling wine.
Okay.
They have to be cold stable, but they don't have to be heat stable.
Now, cold stable, you're talking about tartrates, the formation of tartrate crystals. So you want to make sure you don't have too much tartrate crystal in the wine. So normally you'd chill the wine down, let the tartrate crystals come out, filter them out, and then you're good to go. It won't form tartrate crystals later on, and that's cold stabilization. But what do you do with heat stabilization, and what are you protecting against for that?
You're protecting against a protein. It's protein stability, really, is what it actually is. It's a heat test, and there are various ways and means to do it, and depending on which region of the world and which varieties you're working with, it depends on what the parameters are. And so in my experience, you know, in Australia, the standard test has always historically been something like 6 hours at 80 degrees, holding the wine for 6 hours at 80 degrees and then measuring the NTU before and afterwards. The NTU is the turbidity measurement, so how turbid the sample is.
Hazy, you mean? Hazy. How clear, yep.
Yeah. And the AWRI and all the Australian textbooks tell you that if the wine changes by more than 1 to 1.5 NTUs between those two tests, it's not stable, and then you need to bentonite fine it or treat it with something to remove the protein.
Okay.
So in England, again, with Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, the classic sparkling varieties, we generally don't tend to have a problem with protein instability in those varieties, in those base wines. Again, there are always exceptions that prove that rule, but so we do check, and in a still wine, Bacchus, Sauvage Blanc, Madeleine Angevine, Reichensteiner, any of those varieties that tend to be used in English still wines, white wines this is, and rosés, they are far more likely to be protein unstable. And if they fail the protein stability test, they will not be allowed to use the PDO. Therefore, they can't put English on their label, blah, blah, blah. So they have to pass that PDO heat test, which is not nearly as rigorous as the Australian one. I think it's like 20 minutes at 70 degrees or something ridiculous like that. It's a fairly unrigorous test, should be a little bit more rigorous as far as I'm concerned.
But you look at the climate in Australia and your climate here, and your wine in Australia is going to see warmer climates for an extended period of time than maybe in England.
Yeah, it's not necessarily to do with the climate that the wine's going to be exposed to. It's to do with the naturally occurring proteins in the grapes. And, you know, that we don't tend to have such high protein levels in the varieties that we're using here in England, in the wine styles that we're using. So I have a much higher tolerance for protein instability in my base wines than someone making a Bacchus white wine would.
Okay. All right. I think that's all the main tests. I know you guys do a pressure test, but I imagine most people know how to do a pressure test on things. Have I missed anything out, or is there something really that you think's important?
Well, it's all important. I guess pressure testing is useful as you go after second fermentation to make sure that your fermentation really is happening.
Is happening or has happened?
Is happening and or has happened, because you can get aphrometers which you put on a bottle at bottling, and then you just leave it there and check it every week, and it'll measure the pressure as it's being produced.
Okay.
That's a good guide, but that's obviously only one bottle, so you might need to then randomly check a few others. I'd say, we've covered most of it, I think, yeah.
Cool. Cool. Oh, that's really, really... Oh, well, I've found it really interesting. And there's things I sort of know, but it's quite nice to go through them and get things clarified, because I don't... Unlike yourself, like, you're involved in it all the time. And I think about it occasionally, but not nowhere near enough for these things to be in my brain properly. I tend to forget them a little bit as well.
I get no chance to forget them.
Yeah, I can tell you know it very, 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 very well. What's the biggest problem do you think you see with wineries in the UK with regard when you're doing all your testing?
I think one of the biggest potential problems we have here, which has already shown its face a few times, is calcium instability. And there is no reliable test for it, or easy test. There's no guarantee that you can stop it happening. And as far as I can see, it's going to be something that's going to become more and more of a problem here the UK. You can test for potassium tartrate instabilities, but not calcium. Well, they're quite complicated, usually patented tests that certain product suppliers won't give you what the test is. And even then you can't guarantee it. So that's something, and it can happen pre-bottling, post-bottling, pre-disgorging, post-disgorging, and there's no rhyme or reason as to when it might happen. And if it does happen, then it causes huge problems with the wine.
What is it? I've never actually heard of calcium instability. So what exactly happens?
It's similar to a tartrate instability. So, but you can't fix it by chilling the wine. It's the formation of tiny crystals in the wine, which cause gushing. So obviously tiny crystals in a still wine that are virtually invisible to the naked eye. No one cares or knows that they're even there. In a sparkling wine, they're almost to the point you can't see them. They're so small, but they can cause gushing and you open the bottle. And if it happens after disgorging, you've got no chance to rectify it whatsoever. And then when the customer opens the bottle, half of the wine ends up on the ceiling.
Yeah, I was going to say, because basically the bubbles form on sharp edges or anything in the bottle. And so if you've got these tiny crystals, that's what you mean by gushing. The wine just goes whoosh out and it's all over the place.
And they're not big enough to spot and they're not heavy enough to riddle out. So they don't settle out when you do the riddling because they're in suspension. They're that small and that light that they don't settle. And you've got no idea they're there until it's too late.
And is it a problem because there's a lot of chalk soil, so they pick up the calcium? The wines, the grape juice has higher levels of calcium than maybe if you'd grown it on clay.
It's a nice theory, but I don't think there's any science to back it up.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I've thought about that, but then I've had, you know, I've seen wines that are not grown on chalk do the same. So I don't think it would be a lovely theory and it would match up very nicely, but I don't think it's the case. But I think it's one of those areas that needs to have a lot more work done on it, and solutions to the problem need to be found as well. Easier solutions to the problem.
Is it a problem for the UK or is it a problem in Champagne as well? Or is it?
I definitely know it's a problem in the UK. And I imagine it's a problem in other regions of the world, but you know, Champagne is a notoriously closed shop and they're not going to share that information with the rest of the world. No. If they're having problems, you know, they don't talk about problems. Everything's, you know,
perfect.
Peachy and champagne.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, Emma, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time. I mean, it's been absolutely fascinating going through all these different problems and the issues that you can spot and perhaps how to fix some of them as well, which is fascinating. Thank you very much for your time. It's been brilliant.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.